temps devant nous. Le bonheur sera à nous.
Moon River, the collaborative analog project for members of the Wooden Sky, the Weather Station, and Kathleen Edwards and Lindy Ortega's bands, could be described as a supergroup of sorts, not just because of their collective talents, but for the fact that the music they recorded on their debut album, Volume 1, is simply super. Described as Buddy Holly meets krautrock, it's something you need to hear to fully comprehend. And thanks to the folks at Real Love, Winnipeggers will get a chance to see Moon River on Friday, March 29th at the ANAF John Osborne Legion at 1395 Ellis Avenue alongside special guest The Secret Beach. Advance tickets are available now via Show Pass for $18.86, so get yours and mark your calendar to see Moon River on Friday, March 29th, presented by Real Love Winnipeg and proudly supported by 101.5 UMFM. Let the past go.
Good evening and welcome to Art World Innovators, exploring stories of innovation in the art world. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and you're listening to UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba.
Our guest this evening is Kevin Callagher, also known as Cal, the international award-winning editorial cartoonist for The Economist magazine in London, The Baltimore Sun in the US, and the online newsletter Counterpoint. After graduating from Harvard College with honors, Kevin spent time in London and began a 40-year career as a cartoonist for The Economist. He has earned numerous awards in various countries for his work and been a finalist on two occasions for the Pulitzer Prize in editorial cartooning. Kevin has published over 10,000 cartoons for a variety of publications such as Le Monde, Der Spiegel, New York Times, and he has painted over 150 magazine covers for The Economist and written numerous books such as his 2013 major retrospective collection of his Economist cartoons in his publication entitled Daggers Drawn, 35 Years of Cal Cartoons in The Economist. His work has been widely displayed at national and international exhibitions, including the Tate Gallery in London and the Library of Congress in Washington. Kevin was the president of the Association of American Editorial Cartoonists and Cartoonists' Rights Network International. He is also a sought-after public speaker, addressing audiences in more than 25 countries on issues of current events, satire, cartoons, and freedom of expression. In addition, Kevin has lectured at Oxford, Harvard, Yale, Duke, and Berkeley universities, Pixar Studios, Google headquarters, and he has toured with Chicago's well-known comedy club, Second City, in their show, The Art of Satire. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so very much for taking the time to join us this evening.
Oh, it's great to be here.
I've been the editorial cartoonist for The Economist for over 40 years and been highly recognized for your unique and innovative work as a cartoonist. Can you share the story of your first caricature and how you followed your fascination with caricatures and cartoons, turning it into your career?
Well, one of the curious things, Susan, is that, you know, when you're a cartoonist, there is no conventional way, no conventional route to become a professional cartoonist. Every single one of us has managed to get there in a different path. And mine might be particularly peculiar in that I, as an American, was in the UK having led a bicycle tour of American teenagers to the UK. When it finished, I started cycling around and I got a job playing semi-professional basketball. So I did that for a while, but the team that I was with was not very financially sound, started to lose money. So I was looking for other opportunities while I happened to be in the UK. So I would go on the streets and do caricatures of tourists in any other way that I could exercise both art, but also maybe capitalize on it and get a few pennies. But then I also started to visit all the magazines and newspapers in London, looking for chances and opportunities. And everywhere I went, the people were very kind and generous, but no opportunities came up until I showed up at The Economist one day. Now, they were the last on my list, by the way. I'd been to every single publication over the months. Last on my list was The Economist. And when I'm sitting in the lobby looking at the magazine, now remember, this is 1978, 1978, I guess it was, 1978, the Economist had no photos in it. It was like reading the Bible. It was this great turgid text, right? And so I'm thinking, I've got all these cartoons. These are not going to work in here, but I'm going to try to sell them. I'm going to see what I can do. I had comic strips. I knew that wouldn't work. I had animation. That wasn't going to work. All I had left to show them was a half a dozen caricatures of Harvard professors, and that was maybe it. So I went up to the offices, met the art director, and showed them these things. And he showed interest. He said, leave them with me, and we'll see what we can do. So a couple of days later, I called back, and he says, well, you're not going to believe it, but we have some of these editors here at the magazine who know these guys. They recognize these guys. They like these drawings so much, we'd love to bring you back for a one-day trial next Wednesday. I said, great. So Tuesday night, the night before the trial, we have basketball practice. The practice would go from 8 until 10, and the pubs would close at 10:30. So the fastest we'd run all night would be from the gym at 10 to get to the pub to get a few pints before they closed. And while we're at the pub, I'm sitting with all my mates in the basketball team, and I'm saying, guys, you got to tell me about British politics. I don't know anything about British politics because tomorrow I'm going to be at the Economist for a one-day trial. So they say, look, I don't know if we can help you, but if you go back to your flat tonight, turn on the telly, there's going to be a show called Newsnight, and it's like their roundup of the news. Maybe you'll learn something from that. I said, okay. So I go back to my flat, turn on Newsnight, and they're interviewing the Chancellor of the Exchequer of Great Britain at the time, a chap named Dennis Healey. Now, Dennis Healey was God's gift to caricature. So I brought out a paper and a pencil, and I'm sketching this guy because he has this round tomato face. He's got these eyebrows, these giant eyebrows that kind of shot up to the ceiling, and he has these little bunny rabbit teeth, right? And I'm sketching away with Dennis Healey, but now it's getting late. It's getting near midnight, and I got to be in London in the morning. So I put it away, get on the train the next morning up to London, show up to the Economist, and they say to me, Cal, for your one-day trial, we want you to draw Dennis Healey. And he was the only British politician that I'd ever drawn. And so I aced that one, and I've been with him ever since. Now it's 43, 44 years.
Here's a little story about the first caricature you did. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, the first one I do remember doing. Oh man, I must have been 12 years old, fifth grade in school. I was at a school with nuns, and we had this great music teacher who used to sing with her eyes closed in the front of class. And being the kind of kid that I was that liked to draw things, when I saw that picture of that mouth, I thought, I have got to get this down on paper. So I'm sketching away, and I drew her mouth the size of a battleship, this massive thing with her habit behind her head whipping down. And I was really doing it for myself. But when the girl sitting next to me saw the cartoon, she grabbed it off my desk, had a bit of a giggle, passed it to the person next to her, and soon the cartoon was circulating around the class, and I was a star. I was an instant star. The people thought I was great, all my classmates, until the nun got a hold of the cartoon. And when she saw this, she knew exactly who did it. She grabbed me by the ear, walked me down to the boys' room, and made me take a bite out of a bar of soap. And she said, don't you ever do that again. And I have been doing the cartoons ever since. Because it turns out she was the best teacher I could ever have for being a cartoonist. Because first, I learned that a cartoon can have instant reaction from people all around you. And also, when you're taking on the powerful, in this place, a teacher in the classroom, you knock them down a notch and all the hoi polloi, they think this is great. Except those on the sharp end of your pencil, the teachers and the politicians, they don't respond the same way as all the others do. And you hear back from them. And so that's been my life for the past four decades.
Can you give us an inside look at your creative process as you meet your weekly Wednesday deadlines for The Economist and a little insight to the many hats that you wear as you do it?
Well, one of the things when you're a professional artist, in order to succeed as a professional artist, one of your demons that you have to master is deadlines. You have to learn to be creative on a deadline. When you're doing it for a newspaper or magazine, it's even more acute because the deadlines tend to be tight. In other words, you may get asked to draw something today, it's got to be in tomorrow. So you have to learn equations to be able to be creative and formulate capable, professional ideas in a short period of time. And you're always going to meet that deadline so that people will hire you. In newspapers, when you're doing journalism, it's even more so because journalists, the news is changing all the time, shifting. And so you have to do cartoons that are right up to the last minute. So when I do a cartoon for The Economist, for example, I'll do it on a Wednesday. It's going to be read Thursday morning. And that's often the case with any newspaper artist. You have very tight deadlines. So for me, I'm also being a creative artist, but the political cartoon has this other element, Susan, is that you're a journalist, right? You have to look at the news. You have to evaluate what's going on in the world. Then you're a commentator, like a columnist, where you're finding the news and information. You're gathering it. But then you have to comment on it, find interesting angles in order to make those consumers think about it in a different way. And then you put on the hat as a humorist, in this case, satirist, which is using humor to deliver a message. And then the last hat you put on is that of the artist, where you're assembling all of these other bits, the journalism from here and the columnist from over here and the satirist. And then you've got to package them into this visual entity that you're going to deliver to your audience. So for me, I start with the journalism. You know, you do the research, read, catch up with things. Then I get my piece of paper out and I start sketching notions of subjects that I want to comment on and ways that I'm thinking about things. And then once I've settled on that subject, then becomes the tickle part, where the satire comes in, where I'm looking for interesting elements like composition and interesting metaphors, interesting wordplay that can then deliver my point. And then when I have all these sketches and my ideas become more solidified, I then draw them over and over again, developing them using a light box by putting a sketch down and putting another piece of paper on top of the sketch, resketching it again with more clarity. And eventually I get a pencil sketch after 4 or 5 hours that I think looks like something worthy of being published. At this stage, I then send that sketch to my editors and say, hey guys, this is what I'm thinking of doing today. And they almost always say, yes, you're tremendous. My God, you're brilliant. Let's go for it. And then I spend 3 hours, sometimes longer, 4 hours, sometimes 5 hours, inking and painting that pencil sketch until it finally is my final art that I can scan and send to the publication.
You've mentioned you have to cover a broad range of topics. What's your best material to draw inspiration for your cartoons?
Yes, you're right. The world is your oyster kind of thing, where I'm blessed with the opportunity to comment on so many things around the globe. Depending on the publication and the audience I'm speaking to, add some real interest. In other words, if I do a cartoon for Baltimore Sun, which is a metropolitan newspaper here in the United States. Boy, if I do something on Maryland politics, man, those Maryland politicians watch that like a hawk, because you're the only satirist in this little world here. And so, man, you get everybody's attention. But having said that, there's also times when I want to do cartoons, and I've done a lot of cartoons about the environment, about climate change, because the earth can't defend itself, right? Our environment, it doesn't have a voice. We have to give it voice. And so one of my great missions is to encourage and build the fountain of knowledge and understanding and passion about the environment. But that gets a different kind of reaction to people. So all these different subjects touch on different groups, and all of them from an artist perspective have different kinds of joy that they bring.
You've also been an artist in residence at a number of places. Can you tell us a little about these valuable experiences and why you might recommend them to young students during their career?
Oh, yes. Well, one of the things when people think of the word artist, they think of someone who is off on their own, an individual. They've got a studio. They're out there just doing their thing. And there's a lot of truth to that, and there's a lot of joy in that. But one of the things that if you are blessed to be an artist is that you accumulate knowledge, experience, and a gift. And you're an artist, you're a communicator, right? You're creating something that then is going to be passed down for other people to observe, ingest, and hopefully either enjoy or be involved with your art. The great thing about being an artist in residence, it allows you to share what you've accumulated, your knowledge, your gift, your speciality, with other people, often with younger people. And all of us artists also know that we have learned from other artists before us. And so you have this opportunity to be able to return that favor to others when you are an artist in residence to be able to do that. But the other thing that an artist in residency does is that it's a two-way street. You're teaching other people, but they also teach you. You get something back that helps inform your art. And then often when you're at new places and new environments, and whether it's it may be a learning institution or it can be a new geographic location that you have to be in, your experience, your personal life experience helps inform whatever chosen area you're in, whether you're a singer or architecture or whatever. It's you're gaining artistic wisdom by just being out there in the world. So I strongly recommend that even though many artists are happy in their studio, they get a lot of stuff in your studio, take a step out of that studio, take a step out of your place, engage with the world and share what you have.
You put together a brilliant collection of cartoons in your book, Daggers Drawn, 35 Years of Cal Cartoons and The Economist. Can you tell us a little about what was involved in publishing this book and how you selected what you wanted to include?
Well, so Susan, I've been doing this a long time. It's kind of crazy. You know, I've done like 10,000 cartoons, I think you mentioned. So it was a really interesting experience to go back and look at your old work. And I know this, I mean, talk with so many of my artist friends that when you go back and look at your work and you see your progress through the years, there is part of it is you're wincing because you go, "Ooh, that wasn't so good. Oh, I can't believe I did that." It, you know, you get all that kind of stuff going on. But it's also about your journey. Artists don't stop in one place. They're constantly on a journey. Now, sometimes you slow down if you don't have as much time to invest in your art because life comes up and different with other things. But when you come back, you're on this long path. One of the things about having a long career like I've had, it was a really worthwhile exercise to go back and look at what you've done throughout the course of your career. Now, I've even found it to be very useful to look back at just what I did over the past year. And one of the great things that when you're dealing with visual arts like myself is that you do have a tangible physical example of what you achieved every day. It reads out like an animated movie, actually. Each cartoon is a frame and you can see this development. And you see some of the stuff you did years ago and you go and you scream. You go, "Oh my God, I can't believe that. It was not so good." And my other artist colleagues have the same feeling. In fact, some of my cartoonist friends and artist friends hate to look at their old work because it's so painful. But for me, it's greatly instructive. And you see this where you've come and where you've been. And it then points you also in the direction that you go forward. So for me, distilling some of the best work to get down to, let's say the, I don't know, several hundred cartoons that are in the book was an interesting process. And part of it, we wanted to distribute stuff so it had a great geographical distance and the comics readers are global. And the book had cartoons from all around the world. And you know, it was funny thing, Susan, is that some of these cartoons I saw, I had forgotten that I'd drawn. And I got to see them with the clarity of someone from the outside. And I look at these cartoons, I go, "This guy's pretty good. You know, he's got potential, this guy. Maybe he should stick with it." So it was a really refreshing experience to do that. And sometimes I just pick up the book and just have a little glance through it. And it kind of helps point me in the right direction.
Were there any cartoons you've done since then that you would really have liked to include it, maybe enough to inspire a sequel?
Oh, boy. Well, yeah, I tell you, you know, the world has been pretty crazy the past years. In case anyone hasn't noticed, 2020 was pretty crazy, right? Which means that it's been a fruitful and rich place for cartoons, for satire, for discussion on important global events. And then in America, particularly with the Trump presidency and all the aftermath of that, been really big deal. And I feel, you know, knock on wood, I think I'm doing the best work I've ever done right now. In fact, I think that my 40 years experience, this guy trained me for this moment to be able to pull all of my resources that I've accumulated and to apply them in all the cartoons. Since the book is now 5 years old or thereabouts, I feel that the work that I've done, the body of work I've done from there is strong and maybe worth sharing. Give me another 30 years, I'll do the next book, but it'll all be full of good cartoons, I'm telling you.
You've also explored animating some of your caricatures. Can you tell us about a few of your animated films and your experience touring with Chicago's Second City Comedy Group for the show called Art of Satire?
I'm sure that listeners of this are under the age of 40, where print newspapers and so on seem to be a vestige of a past era. And I think that there's a lot of truth in that. And as a result, we are all in my business, the visual satire business, are looking for the new venues, basically to go where the eyeballs are. That's what we want to do. Our job is to try to shift society in certain directions. So you go to where people are looking at. So in the new digital landscape, clearly still images have some value, but moving images have some real power. And the prospect of being able to take a still cartoon, well-rendered, well-thought-out, and make it come to life, I think adds a prospect of really powerful and meaningful artwork that's going to affect the conversation. So since I graduated from university in 1977, I've been exploring this. My senior thesis was a 13-minute long animated cartoon. And so I've really loved this, and I've been exploring this in different ways. And in 2008, we had a great experience. And it was the early days of motion capture and people dressing up in skin-tight leotards and having your pictures being taken so that an individual moving could then turn into an animated character moving, like we see in all the special effects in movies these days. And we actually were able to make a live show where I was traveling around the country with Second City. I created a Barack Obama and a John McCain. They were these full 3D characters. And I could be backstage in a motion capture suit. And whenever I would move, those characters on screen in front of a thousand people in the audience would come alive and could talk to the audience. And so it suddenly had a live cartoon. I just thought this was so cool. So you can imagine that this will be taking on big ways. There was a great television show in Quebec, which uses the exact same technology called Le Floc. And it's a great satirical piece that ran for many years. So you're going to see more and more of this in the future. But these days, people see animated GIFs and shorter animations because now with computer animation, everybody, including non-cartoonists, can now turn moving pictures into satire using animation. I think it's really exciting.
Do you often draw your own caricature into a cover or a cartoon?
Well, it's the Alfred Hitchcock in me, you know, is that if there's a crowd scene, I'll draw myself in it usually, just kind of for fun from my family and friends. And then occasionally, I know I did one for The Economist just last week, where when you have to draw the everyman, the every person who represents all of us, it's a tough. If you do a crowd, then you can get all the mixes of gender and age and race into a crowd. So that does seem more as a collective. But if either the demands of the cartoon or the design element narrows it down to one or two people, who is that? So I think the best thing to do is to make that me so that people may not know it's me, but those who do. So if you see a bearded, bespeckled gentleman or bewhiskered gentleman with white hair in the cartoon these days, that's probably me.
Can you speak to some of the risks cartoonists take in publishing their political cartoons and how this may have led you to become involved as president for the international human rights group called the Cartoonist Rights Network?
It's a funny thing when you and I can talk about cartoons, because here in the West, when we hear cartoons, a smile goes to our face. We think it's going to be something funny, right? But in much of the world, a cartoon can be a very dangerous thing. And particularly for those people who live in societies where the leaders do not like to be criticized. There was a recent report that came out from this group called Freedom House, that's kind of a press watchdog group. And they suggested that only 15% of the world's population live in a place where there's freedom of the press, 15%. And that almost exactly, by the way, overlaps with the amount of places in the world that allow a cartoonist to draw their own head of state. So we in Canada and in the US who have this opportunity to do it, we take this all for granted, but to do in other places as a cartoonist, you're putting your life on the line. And around the globe, we've had cartoonists who are arrested, jailed, tortured, and murdered because of the work that they do. And it just seems so surprising and outrageous that that should take place, but it's just a matter of fact in much of the world. So I have, as part of my cherishing this amazing opportunity that I've had in my life, is to do my best to put a spotlight on those cartoonists around the world who have either gotten in trouble for what they do, or at least try to help them if they have gotten in trouble. So I was for a time president of the Cartoonist Rights Network, an international organization. Our current president is in Scotland at the moment. And we have helped cartoonists get out of trouble as best we can. And of course, everyone remembers a few years ago when Charlie Hebdo, when several cartoonists, I think five or six, were murdered because of what they did in a magazine in Paris. Those kind of threats linger over many of us cartoonists all the time. Even here in the US, where we have so many freedoms, but we also, every cartoon you do is going to tick somebody off, I'm afraid. This is just what we do. And in our country, we have 300 and 50 million guns. So it only takes one person really angry to cause some problems. So as a result, as a cartoonist doing in my business, you want to do cartoons responsibly, but you're always aware that you're dealing with a hand grenade when you draw your cartoon every day.
Do you have any special projects coming up that you'd like to share with our audience?
Well, I'm in the very early stages of a graphic novel with a environmental theme. And I think that this is going to take a while to do, but I'm very excited about that. In part, I think, as mentioned before, you know, about doing environmental cartoons, it's really an important subject matter. Also, partly because there is a certain power that graphic imagery can provide. And I would love to use the tool that I've mastered over these years to be able to deal with this really important subject and be able to present it to a younger audience. I think that that's my goal.
Any clues for what you have planned for next week's issue of The Economist?
Well, I tell you what's so cool. I love this. This is my person. This is I really love improvisation. I love working with Second City. Improvisation. I played basketball my whole life. Basketball is highly improvisational. And this is what happens with cartoons, is that a cartoon, you don't know what story is coming up next week. But you wait when that story comes. You're ready for it. You got to go for it. You know, you improvise on the moment. Somebody throws something at you, you got to juggle, make something of it. So there's obviously some big themes and things that are going to be happening over the course of a year. You know, might be elections, there might be international gatherings and things of that nature. But I'm always waiting and seeing what's going to happen. I will say this, is that we all know that our economies are going to be eventually opening up. The weather is going to be getting better. And hopefully there's going to be more smiles on people's faces. And so that's going to be, whatever it is, it should be more joyous time, I'm hoping, the weeks and months ahead.
Well, I'd like to thank you so much for sharing your story and your invaluable insight with our audience. It's been a pleasure speaking to you, and we wish you continued success.
Thank you very much, Susan. Good luck to all of your gang.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and we thank you for listening to Art World Innovators here on UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Join us again next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. for more on today's innovators in the art world.
Boop! Yeah, I don't know what that item is. Boop! Yeah, still no. Boop! Is that kale? Boop! Baby kale. Boop! A coupon. Cute. I'm not really designed to help customers save money, if you know what I mean. Boop. Okay, what did you just put in my bagging area? I need help. Human!
Who is self-checkout working for? Self-reflect before you self-check. A message from UFCW Local 832.
Canadian R&B artist Afros has just released her brand new album, Roses. Her soaring three-octave range and ability to honor the golden era of soul with a modern touch are a testament to her unbelievable talent. Afros has sung backup for Daniel Caesar, Jesse Reyes, and Charlotte Day Wilson, and opened for Chantal Kreviatsik. With Roses, Afros bridges the sounds of yesterday and today. Roses is available for purchase and is on all streaming platforms now.
Oh, radio, radio. What? No.
You're listening to CJUMFM 101.5, broadcasting from the University of Manitoba at 1200 watts.
Radio.
Thank you. Another storm is passing through. It brings back thoughts of you. And when the days were far too long, and the nights come in your eyes, I could do no wrong. That train's passing through, the one that brings me to you. But you're gone from the end of the line, and I have lost what was once mine. In my eyes, the stars, they don't shine. And I can't fight it anymore. And I won't hide it anymore. Without you, you.